unexpected salvo is fired in the user fee debate. United says 950 pilots will be furloughed. And Alaska Airlines will speed up retirement of its MD-80s. This is Aero News. I'm Paul Plack. Thanks for downloading this AeroCast. Here's what's up in aviation for Wednesday, June 25th, 2008. It looks as though the hopes of getting the U.S. Senate to move on FAA reauthorization are dead till sometime next year now. But the user fee battle apparently takes no vacations. On Tuesday, two Washington, D.C.-based think tanks threw new fuel on that fire. The Institute for Policy Studies and Essential Action issued a joint report reviving the notion that private business jets are strangling the nation's air traffic control network, clogging airports and runways, and contributing to global warming. EA Director Robert Weissman wrote, quote, "The super wealthy private jet set are shifting the costs of their high-flying indulgence onto the rest of us. They pollute more than commercial flight passengers, but don't pay. They don't pay a fair share of their air traffic control costs, and they have manipulated the tax code so we all subsidize the cost of private jet purchases," unquote. The airline industry lobbying group Air Transport Association welcomed the report, which actually manages to make the ATA's own statements look tame. General aviation groups quickly circled the wagons. The Alliance for Aviation Across America, an anti-user fee coalition assembled by the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association, called the report, quote, "the latest chapter in the airline's playbook, as these Washington, D.C. think tanks mimic the airline's dubious data manipulation techniques and parrot their talking points," unquote. The General Aviation Manufacturers Association said the report, quote, "resurrects the well-worn and worn-out airline industry claim the GA does not pay its fair share, when in fact the airlines themselves drive the costs of a hub-and-spoke model that was built primarily to meet their needs," unquote. Gamma adds that GA pilots already pay their fair share to support air traffic control through hefty fuel taxes, which would climb even higher under the FAA reauthorization bills, which passed in the House last year but stalled this year in the Senate. Ed Bolin, president of the National Business Aviation Association, called the report's description of business aircraft operators as wealthy jet setters, quote, "a ridiculous caricature of general aviation," unquote. United Airlines announced capacity cuts June 4th and now says that will mean 950 pilots will lose their jobs by the end of 2009. In addition, another 500 already on personal or military leave won't be coming back. The move reflects the airline's plan to park its entire fleet of Boeing 737s and some older 747s. In a prepared statement to Reuters, the airline said, quote, "as we reduce the size of our fleet and take actions company-wide to enable United to compete in an environment of record fuel prices, we must take the difficult but necessary step to reduce the number of people we have to run our business," unquote. The layoffs comprise almost 15% of United's entire pilot workforce and serve as a chilling backdrop to upcoming discussions with other unions. There was no immediate comment from the Airline Pilots Association. In more fuel cost-related news, Pacific Northwest Alaska Air Group, parent company of Alaska Airlines, says it will spend an extra $60 million to hasten the planned retirement from service of its elderly and thirsty McDonnell Douglas MD-80s. Alaska announced earlier this year it would park 107 MD-80s by the end of this year, but now says the shift will be completed by the end of August. The Seattle Times reports the $60 million will pay off existing leases on four planes. Alaska will report $30 million of the total on this quarter's financials, the other half in this year's fourth quarter. Some of the trimming will involve reductions in capacity, but some routes will be served by more efficient Boeing 737s. Anyone who says CEOs don't earn their salaries hasn't run Airbus. As if the ongoing fight by partner Northrop Grumman to retain a U.S. Air Force tanker contract wasn't enough, Businessweek reports workforce restructuring among the company's manufacturing facilities has French and German unions at each other's throats. French employees are complaining that 2,000 Germans brought to Toulouse, France as temps to fix problems on the A380 never left. The French also say they've shouldered a disproportionate share of cost reductions. The Germans are unhappy because some work on aircraft cabins has been shifted from Hamburg to Toulouse. Airbus CEO Tom Enders displayed a knack for understatement, quote, "the social climate is not good," unquote. He told the French business newspaper La Tribune, quote, It's impossible to change everything at the same time and at the same speed. To have a total permanent equilibrium, as some of our unions want, is absolutely unrealistic, unquote. He also blamed a lack of integration in Airbus, caused by nationalism, training, and language problems, for the need to bring German workers to France to finish work started in Germany. Anders admitted that allegations of insider trading by executives is not helpful and is part of an erosion in the company's image and stock price. He also confirmed that he is a target in the probe. Anders told La Tribune the charges are absurd, but he said, quote, "It's evidence that this case is seriously damaging our reputation and that of the company," unquote. Coming up next, the end of the shuttle won't cost as many jobs as thought. Gear-up landings can be expensive, especially in an F-16. And what happens to the pocket change left behind at airport checkpoints? You're listening to Aero News.
At Cirrus Design, we don't ignore the fundamentals of aviation design. We just give them an ingenious new interpretation. For 3 years running, the Cirrus SR-22 G2 has been the world's best-selling single-engine four-seat airplane. Today, the SR-22 G2 defines the new Cirrus standard model. Why? We'd love to invite you to see for yourself by taking a ride in the new breed of airplane that has taken the aviation industry by storm. To learn more, call 888-750-9927 or on the web at cirrusdesign.com. Finally, aviation headsets have evolved. Clarity Aloft is the next generation of headset design for a number of reasons. For instance, the noise-canceling microphone used in the Clarity Aloft headset is a high-fidelity, noise-canceling electret condenser microphone with performance optimized for speech frequencies in extremely high-noise environments. Stage performers and musicians use this same microphone because they must insist on the highest level of sound reproduction. For more information, call 612-747-3197 or check out the innovative Clarity Aloft headset on the web at clarityaloft.com.
We're back with more of your Aero Briefing for June 25th, 2008. On the web, you can find us at www.aero-news.net. I'm Paul Plack. NASA had bad news and good news for Florida's Space Coast this week. The bad news, between 3,000 and 4,000 jobs will be eliminated at Kennedy Space Center once the space shuttle fleet is retired in late 2010. The good news, that's down from 7,000 predicted earlier. The reason for the difference, says Administrator Michael Griffin, is that about 3,000 positions will open in the Constellation manned space program now under development. Griffin made his comments to a Senate panel on Monday. Florida Senator Bill Nelson, chairman of the Space Subcommittee, called the news a step in the right direction. He remains critical of the Bush administration's hard deadline of 2010 to ground the space shuttle fleet, starting a 5-year reliance on Russia for space transport until the U.S. Constellation program is ready to fly in 2015. Griffin agreed, saying he finds it unseemly in the extreme that NASA will need to rely on Russia. Quote, "However, I can't find a way to avoid it," unquote. Have you ever dumped your loose change into a bin at a TSA airport checkpoint, then forgotten it and left it behind? Well, if so, you're not alone. TSA says it has collected and kept more than $1 million in the past 3 years from airline passengers who forget coins at checkpoints. The policy started October 2004, when the agency lobbied Congress to amend federal law and let the TSA put the money toward security costs. Before that, money left at checkpoints just disappeared into the vast darkness of the U.S. Treasury's general fund. Surprisingly, USA Today reports there's a big difference among airports and regions in how much change is left behind. So who's more careful with their money? Well, in the 3 years ending last October 1st, passengers at Los Angeles International left behind more than $89,000. At Chattanooga Metropolitan Airport in Tennessee, the 2007 total was just $1.20. The TSA says coins are left by passengers who are too rushed to bother or who lose sight of it in gray-colored bins. Don Thomas, an official with the Screeners Union and a screener himself at Orlando International Airport, theorizes that foreign travelers leaving the U.S. realize the coins will be worthless to them when they get back home. Sadly, with the decline in the value of the U.S. dollar, some domestic travelers may reach that same conclusion. But the TSA itself is very tight with its change. Screeners who pocket the change instead of turning it over to the agency are taking a big risk. TSA spokeswoman Sterling Payne says, quote, TSA takes the handling of any passenger items, whether left voluntarily or involuntarily, very seriously, unquote. She adds that one screener was fired for pilfering a nickel and two pennies. Apparently, even the U.S. Air Force has those who have and those who will. Air Force officials at Randolph Air Force Base in Texas recently completed their investigation of the April 2nd F-16 accident at Arizona's Gila Bend Auxiliary Airfield. The verdict? Pilot error, landing after failing to put the gear down. The F-16 was assigned to the 56th Fighter Wing at Luke Air Force Base in Arizona. The aircraft was flown by a student going through the instructor pilot upgrade course. An instructor, also assigned to the 61st, was sitting in the front seat. Their mission that day was practicing approaches flown from the back seat by the student. The report says the student made a successful approach and landing, but then before taking off again, retracted the gear before advancing the throttle. Neither pilot was injured, and other than damage to the aircraft, there was no property damage. There's no word yet on whether the student got his upgrade to instructor. There's a thaw in the political air between mainland China and Taiwan. Businessweek reports a new agreement will allow Taiwanese carriers China Airlines and EVA to add direct service between the island and the mainland starting July 4th. The two carriers were previously allowed to fly only charters around the holidays. Now, they'll begin regular weekend charter service between 5 Chinese cities and 8 Taiwanese cities. One odd requirement will be that they fly over Hong Kong, a special administrative jurisdiction, before continuing on into China. In contrast to U.S. carriers, which find international flights their most profitable, the two Taiwanese carriers have been losing money flying overseas. Morgan Stanley estimates the carriers could save at least 70% on the fuel costs of the new trips if they could lose the Hong Kong flyover requirement. But even with it in place, China Airlines and EVA believe the new charters will be profitable. Beijing has further agreed to chartered flights to 5 more Chinese cities and a doubling in the number of cross-strait flights to 72 a week after the Olympics. Both sides hope to take advantage and plan to hold further talks within the next 3 months addressing further increases. Still ahead, ExoJet gets a new chief marketing officer. China joins an international space standards organization. And that airline smoking lounge smells a little like oregano. You're listening to Aero News.
Remember what the future used to look like? The flying cars, the spaceports, the rocket packs and spandex outfits. That was some future, wasn't it? But hey, here's the real future. A Garmin Wass Navigator. It makes its own glide path out of GPS signals, so you can land IFR at thousands of airports with no ILS or other ground-based approach aids. Now that's a future you can believe in. Garmin Wass GPS. Follow the leader.
Uncramp your style in a new Citation CJ2 Plus from Cessna. Now with integrated ProLine 21 avionics, FADEC, and a restyled cockpit and cabin. In the CJ2 Plus, you'll carry more payload than you could in the original CJ2. You'll climb and cruise faster. You'll have the freedom to use even shorter runways. And you'll do it all on less fuel. For a sure thing, call 1-800-4-CESSNA.
We're back to wrap up your Aero Briefing for Wednesday, June 25th, 2008. I'm Paul Plack. On Tuesday, business aircraft fractional ExoJet announced the appointment of Adam Comack as Chief Marketing Officer. Comack will define and drive marketing and customer experience strategies and programs for ExoJet's global private jet service. President and CEO Paul Tao welcomed Comack as a proven marketing leader. Quote, Adam understands our target customers and his ability to translate that understanding into authentic and engaging brand experiences will be instrumental as we further accelerate ExoJet's revenue growth and market leadership, unquote. Comack is the second high-level hire to come to ExoJet from premium business class airline EOS, following Eilif Sirk Hansen, who segued from CFO at EOS to CFO at ExoJet. Prior to joining EOS, Comack was Senior Vice President at Gray Direct Marketing Group, where he oversaw overall strategic direction and management of more than $110 million of integrated marketing activities for companies like Adobe Systems, Sendence Retail Travel Services Division, and JP Morgan Chase. The Consultative Committee for Space Data Systems, or CCSDS, announced on Monday the China National Space Administration has been accepted as the 11th full member agency of the organization and the first new member since 1997. CCSDS is an international organization for space communication standards and relies on members to provide technical engineering support to its working groups. China's inclusion will help promote greater cooperation and interoperability among the space and ground assets of the major space exploration agencies around the world. Members of the Denver-based organization Safer Alternative for Enjoyable Recreation are calling on the government to allow travelers to smoke marijuana in the same airport lounges currently okayed for tobacco smoking. KDVR-TV in Denver reports the group's press release points out the idea will address the growing number of in-flight problems involving drunk and disorderly passengers. Members claim marijuana is a better alternative to alcohol to help more flyers relax and deal with the anxiety of air travel. 3 years ago, Denver voters made their city the first in the nation to make possession of 1 ounce or less of marijuana legal. It was largely symbolic because Denver city attorneys can still use state and federal law to prosecute marijuana cases. Airlines have yet to weigh in on the idea. You would think they'd welcome anything that makes passengers calmer, reducing hostile incidents on board, and improving the safety of flight attendants. More importantly, charging for snacks would suddenly become a major revenue line. Finally today, pilot, engineer, and rotorcraft pioneer John M. Miller left us on Monday morning at the age of 102. If you're not a gyroplane enthusiast, you may not have heard of Captain Miller before, and that would be unfortunate. He's contributed much to aviation in general and served as a feisty example of how to enjoy your golden years. John said last year that he still remembered, if not clearly, the moment when the aviation bug bit him. It was May 29, 1910. John was 4 years old, and he saw Glenn Curtis fly down the Hudson River to claim a $10,000 prize offered by the New York World newspaper for a flight to New York City from the state capital in Albany. His later introduction to aerobatic flight and witnessing of Charles Lindbergh's departure on his transatlantic record flight cemented John's life's course. After becoming a mechanical engineer and barnstormer, John became interested in the potential of the autogyro and ordered a Pitcairn PCA-2 in 1931. He would name it Missing Link, which turned out to be prophetic of the gyroplane's role as a stepping stone in the development of the helicopter. John planned a transcontinental flight to demonstrate the machine's capabilities. When he discovered the factory had bumped his production slot to get a machine to Amelia Earhart first for her own transcontinental attempt, he made arrangements to get checked out in another experimental gyro, knowing that Amelia was waiting to get checked out in her own machine. That decision allowed him to depart the moment his aircraft was delivered. He reportedly got the machine, made 5 test hops, and headed west, breaking in the 330-horsepower Wright radial along the way. He left Poughkeepsie, New York on May 14, 1931, and arrived in San Diego on the 29th, beating Earhart's attempt by 10 days, and setting a record time which would stand for 72 years, until Andy Keach broke that record flying a modern tractor gyroplane in 2003. Miller later talked Congress and President Franklin Roosevelt into testing airmail deliveries by autogyro between the roofs of post offices in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and Camden, New Jersey. As part of the test, which started in July of 1939, he got all weather limitations written for fixed-wing aircraft waived for all rotorcraft, a distinction which survives largely intact to this day. He completed the year's test with a perfect dispatch record, although another gyro pilot he trained suffered an accident while taxiing after landing. John called Missing Link an absolutely excellent aircraft. He bragged that it needed only an oil change after the transcontinental flight and was sold after 2,400 hours with the original air in one of the tires. The autogyro faced extinction with the development of the first stable helicopters. John went on to serve as a captain for United Airlines and later Eastern, flying the DC-2 and DC-3 and the Boeing 247. He served as a test pilot for the Grumman J-2F-5 Duck amphibian, worked as an active flight instructor well into his 90s, and was still flying his 1969 Bonanza at age 102. He complained that the FAA required him to fly with a safety pilot in his last few years, refusing to believe anyone his age could have passed a legitimate medical exam. The Monday edition of the Poughkeepsie Journal quoted Miller's daughter, Trish Taylor, as saying John died of natural causes after a 2-day stay in a hospital that marked his first ever use of prescription medications. After a life filled with remarkable experiences and accomplishments and no shortage of funny quips, his last reported words were, quote, "I guess my flying days are over," unquote. John, with all due respect, I doubt that very much. And that's the latest from Aero News. Remember to check out the ANN special feature. In February last year, John Miller spent an evening sharing stories from his life at a meeting of the Dutchess County Pilots Association in New York. It was captured in an audio recording. We'll hear a few highlights. And if you haven't done it yet, subscribe to our AeroCasts. Find them on iTunes, Yahoo, Odeo, and at our website, www.aero-news.net. I'm Paul Platt. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.